Hi, my name is Fiona. I work with human and non-human beings as feral practice. Listener is an audio drama that mingles human and non-human characters. Our two narrators are on site at Orr Gunpowder Works and later down on the marshes beside Orr Creek. As they unfold Orr's explosive past and current challenges, they're informed and interrupted by some local inhabitants, including noctule bats, wading birds, a bamboo worm, and a dragonfly. Listener is titled after a character in the novel Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban, and is inspired by a story he tells in the book called The Other Voice Owl of the World. This owl spends every night swallowing the sounds of the world, and so disappearing all the beings who make those sounds. But he does this in an underhand way so that hardly anyone notices. But listener notices and starts to listen the sounds back each day while the owl sleeps, so holding their destruction at bay. In our current time, alive to the climate crisis, global disease vectors, and species extinctions, this artwork imaginatively listens to and voices a few of the rare and threatened species who make Orr their home, and wills them back towards flourishing.
It's a fine evening in late spring here at Gunpowder Wharf, and the light is just starting to shift from blue tones to red. The colour that dominates is green, but this place, now so pleasant, so peaceful, was once dedicated to the manufacture of efficient human death, killing at scale, at distance. You see this lovely ruin of a rounded wall near the entrance. Its warm pinkish brick merging to white looks innocent, and its smooth curves could be reminiscent of a girl's cheekbone. But elsewhere, the same pale bricks draw sheer vertiginous drops onto inexplicably raised discs of concrete, and over there, a shattered iron tooth lurks at the bottom of a dark hole, like something from a gargantuan nightmare. So, let's think about colour. Let's ponder the red that shouts of life and love and growls of murder, damage and fury. The sickly and the sunshine of yellow, the endless polarities of black and white that bring in with their utterance and opposition, a palpable whiff of oppression.
In 1916, journalist Rebecca West visits a cordite factory in Gretna, in which female workers wear capes of scarlet,
looking for all the world like a dark army of little red riding hoods.
By order of the War Office,
or the Three Bears from Goldilocks,
the red-caped women are stirring, with their bare hands, an evil porridge. One composed not of oats and milk, but gun cotton and nitroglycerine, which they pass on to others who calmly knead and roll it into ropes of differing thickness.
In the world of Ridley Walker, the novel by Russell Hoban, the recipe for gunpowder has mutated into a fragmented and cryptic rhyme, whose fulfillment is pursued by the book's protagonists with no comprehension of its dire implication. The story takes place in Inland, a mythic version of East Kent, but in a bleakly Iron Age future where modern science, technology and culture has been obliterated by nuclear war. As the young heroes of the story, the titular Ridley and his blind moon brother, Listener, grope forwards towards disaster, their thinking is profoundly colour-coded. Key workers, the charcoal burners, are uniformed in red, just like those cordite workers. Once a year, They break their solitude to visit the villagers and get paid in the currency of their signature red cloth. On firing, the red of the alder tree slowly turns to the black of charcoal, the first component of gunpowder. Black is the colour of the night and the colour of the first knowing, intuition, instinct. Ridley and listener are pulled through the plot by listening into the night.
Charcoal burners and cloth dyers share the knowledge of red and black, and also of white. The mordant for the dyeing of the red cloth is saltpeter, or potassium nitrate, a white crystalline salt that can be mined from the ground or processed from manure. In the early days of gunpowder, of cannon and bullet warfare, saltpeter men had special dispensation from the king to dig any soil that they suspected might contain the crusting nitrate.
Any soil, even if it happened to be under your house. So, if someone knew how to make the stuff, that was some pretty strong vugan. In Ridley Walker, it's made from pig shit.
I discovered a recipe for manufacturing saltpeter on a prepper's website. Presumably, it's quite handy to be able to make your own gunpowder if you're intent on bringing down the US government. For this recipe, you need a large amount of animal crap. But first, you need to prepare somewhere to put it. You need to make a bed.
Let's hope you don't have to lie in it.
The bed needs a floor that holds water. A clay floor is traditional. Cover your floor with manure, wood ash, and straw. Make a roof to protect your bed from rain and sun. Now, your bed can be any size, but since this is a long process that doesn't yield a whole lot of saltpeter, the bigger the better. 15 by 10 feet and a few feet deep is a good goal. Sides are desirable, but not required. Now, the fun begins. Continually dump urine on the pile.
You got to wee in the bed. Oh my.
The goal is to keep the bed moist but not dripping wet. If you want an improved bed, you can add drains or even a slope to allow you to collect the runoff from the heap, which can then be added back in or saved for later in case you get dehydrated. You need to turn the top of the bed every week and the whole heap every month. This mixing will encourage saltpeter to form throughout, not just in patches.
It all sounds so fragrant.
So now we come to yellow. The third component of gunpowder is sulphur, known as Yellow Boy Stone in Ridley Walker and as Brimstone in the Bible. Sulphur can't be dug in England, we don't have the geology, but it's an abundant element found in active volcanoes and on top of salt domes.
Whatever they are.
In the book, it's found by listener and Ridley in the pocket of a dead man lying on a wrecked boat in shallow water off the Warnings at Folkestone, which obviously we know as the Warren at Folkestone. Sulphur has a very low melting point, but it isn't a good conductor of heat, so if you touch a lump of sulphur, the heat of your hand will cause its surface to expand and fracture, making crackling noises. Ridley tells us that
listener took that little bag of little crumbly stones in his hands. He said, "This is what I've been listening. Hold it in your hands and you can feel it in them stones and scrabbling to get out. You can hear it whispering to itself and clacking like a skelter of crabs."
Sulphur isn't toxic till it burns or is combined with other elements. But then, well, you get sulfuric acid and you get mustard gas. All the raw materials and finished gunpowder were transported from the gunpowder works on punts via brick and clay-lined canals that led to Awe Creek.
See now how all the different shades of green are reclaiming this damaged place, making a patch of light.
I'm trying to listen to what the human's saying.
A grinding machine for the combination of red, yellow, black, and white. For the production of death. High above you, where the green of the canopy meets the blue of the sky. A blue.
Oh, for pity's sake. I give up. Dad? Dad, wake up! Wake up! It's getting dusky and I'm starving. It must be nearly time to go out. It's a beautiful evening. Hardly a breath. I can hear the birds sing all the way to Feversham.
I can hear motorbikes.
Yes, yes. But listen, beyond the motorbikes, and the lorry, and the cars, and the aeroplane, and the streamer, I can hear a song thrush singing all the way over in Feversham. I think it might be Francis. You know what a strong voice he has?
Good baritone.
An asset to the choir.
If you could bloody hear it.
Don't start, Dad.
The choir used to be exceptional around here. First class. And you could really hear it. The trills, the complex juxtapositions, the moving dynamics. Now? When I was a pup, it was already bad with the machines. But now, bloody racket all day long. No better at weekends. Constant. One thing or another. Always driving somewhere or killing some poor plant. Never bloody shut up. Actually, last year, our beautiful old oak. The sound of those chainsaws cut me to the marrow. I'll never forget it. Sonic trauma is what it was. And ruthlessness. And for what? Oh, it's too near the footpath. It's got a fungus. It might be dangerous. Where do they expect the bats to bloody live since all the bloody barns get knocked down and all the roof holes have got blocked with bloody insulation? Nasty, itchy, bloody stuff. We nocturnal bats, Elodie, we've got the most sensitive hearing on the planet. Everyone knows that.
Well, I don't know if that's quite true.
Most sensitive hearing on the planet. Hear a moth blink, us nocturnals. Ears like knives. But they don't take that into account, do they? When they build their blooming roads and airports and factories and start hacking at every plant in sight.
At least this place is quieter than it used to be, from what the human was saying.
They vote us, what is it, Bat of the Year. And not just for 1 year, for 2 years. That's one whole year, Elodie. That's as long as you've been alive, then the next year too. They spout all this gumph about protecting us, special measures against development, can't disturb the bats, blah, blah, blah. And then they never bloody shut up. Bats don't count for much when some big shot comes along, throws cash around the place. When they want to mow their bloody lawn for the 50th time in a week and we're trying to kip.
Quieter than when your greaty great greats were here, Dad. You know, when this place was a factory.
Nah, it was quieter then. All banked up, wasn't it? All water driven. Less people than now.
But not when, you know, when it happened. The one big one you told me about. And the other times, the not so big ones.
The one big one? Yeah, well, that's different. Terrible time. What the vampire were they thinking? Did they mean it to happen? So many of their own, blown to smithereens. Weirdest bloody lot, them humans.
Deaf or dead, you told me. For acres. All the land creatures and all the birds. Deaf or dead. Even tiny ones.
Birthing time, isn't it?
Spring. Everyone nesting and denning. Some with eggs or chicks or pups or kits.
That's trauma on another level. All the near birds went deaf. Can you imagine? A place of deaf birds. I could even sing. Not even worrying about the choir now, just how would deaf birds know where anyone was?
I wonder how long it lasted. At least it comes back. Is it true that for walkers and diggers, their hearing never comes back? It's gone forever.
Never comes back, no, love. And what good is a fox or a rabbit or a mouse without ears? Poor buggers still die. Just slower.
Don't bear thinking about, Dad. Chills the bones.
Just be glad you're a bat, Elodie. Ears like knives. Come on, let's fly. Bat.
Bat.
Father and daughter race up into the purple night, up and out over the canopy of bison wood, joining others of their kind in their crackling supersonic chorus. Skimming close over the trees, Elodie picks her first moth of the night, deftly, from the air. During the Great War, though, it was a different, deathly yellow that spread across all marshes.
By 1914, the British military used TNT to fill their shell casings, and by 1916, the appetite for them was vast and unremitting. As ever more men were called away to the front, ever more women joined the munitions factories that mushroomed around the marshes. TNT was originally invented not for its explosive abilities, but for its properties as a yellow dye. As the women mixed the toxic compound by hand, they turned head to toe yellow. Their hair went ginger, their urine glowed red. They got called, affectionately or patronisingly, canaries. Real canaries were first bred in the 17th century by Spanish sailors from birds trapped in the Macaronesian Islands. In the early days, most of the female birds were killed and only the singing males were sold. This maintained the bird's status as an exclusive, fashionable adornment to the kingly courts of Spain and England. Later, females got traded as well. Prices dropped and canaries became an affordable pet, not to mention carbon monoxide detector in coal mining and animal model in brain research. As well as yellow skin and red urine, TNT fashions two distinct types of waste product, pink water and red water. If these escape, they poison the land, seeping into and destroying the soil. By 1916, the factory here was one of several on the marshes busy making munitions for the war. On the 31st of March, Her Majesty's Inspector of Explosives, Major Aston Cooper Key, visits the explosives loading company at Upleys. He reports the stacks of materials piling up everywhere, inside and out, as the factory struggles to quadruple their output. The Major takes particular note of a stack of TNT sacks outside building 833. The bags are protected by a weatherproof tarp, but TNT has stained the bags and the ground yellowy-brown around them. Still, he passes the site as satisfactory and goes on his way home. 2 days later, the factory explodes, with the loss of 108 human lives and many more casualties. Accidents happen quite often in munitions factories.
And even when they don't, off you go to work of a morning, making the stuff that's designed to blow people apart.
Good day at the factory, darling.
Yes, rather. Delia and I made enough TNT to blow up 500 blokes today.
Top hole. What's for tea?
Mincemeat.
Brian Dillon's book on the subject goes into detail about the crater and the soil at the site of the explosion. He describes a wave of silt and mud that erupted from the crack to surround the crater in all directions. 5,000 cubic yards of silt. A wave of mud in which the remains of building 833, living and dead people, and untold body parts were sunk and embedded.
A version for the All Marshes in toxic miniature of the horrors of the Somme.
The shockwave reached Southend, was heard in Norwich, and blew the dockyard doors open in Chatham. Dillon describes the oddities of explosive damage, how one person can be killed instantly while the person standing next to them walks away with just an earache, how a man running from an exploding building can think he's escaped, only to be felled by the shockwave at 40 yards. How women standing 30 yards from the blast can be unharmed, but those at 100 yards are blown to pieces. How some bodies atomize and completely disappear. How other bodies are ripped apart to cover hundreds of square yards. Blast damage and shell shock in humans is confusing. To understand it better, the military blow up a series of animals, cats, dogs, rabbits and frogs,
but not canaries,
are placed in crates next to exploding shells and bombs, and what survives of them is tested in various ways. Are they deaf? Are they blind?
Do they look stupid?
A cat described as looking slow and stupid gets out of the crate and settles by a warm fire. The day after, it doesn't move when lightly pushed in the head with a foot. The day after that, it's dead. Very little is known about the impact of explosive weapons on wild flora and fauna. Ground-dwelling wildlife is hardly likely to flourish on an active battlefield, but literature of the Great War often mentions the birds. In Sebastian Folk's novel, birdsong stands testament to nature's indifference to humankind, and so it pains the hero. But for the real-life private, Billy Williamson, the most abiding memory of the song was the birdsong. In that short gap, when the artillery barrage stopped, and before the whistles blew for us to get out of the trench and start running, it was beautiful. The loud bangs of modern fireworks can cause birds tachycardia and even death by fright, and makes others abandon their nests, crash into buildings, or fly out to sea. At least, if a bird loses its hearing due to an explosion, the damaged cells grow back. Not like mammals.
Not like us.
Weirdly, bats, whose hearing is so astonishingly acute, are immune to noise-induced deafness. Scientists speculate that's because bats are so noisy themselves. Bat calls can be as quiet as 50 decibels, but as loud as 120, which is like a smoke detector going off 10 centimetres from your ear. Not much is known about hearing loss in insects, but if they do lose their hearing, it must be as devastating for them as it is for birds. Some insects, such as grasshoppers, stridulate their messages to one another, drawing their long hind legs across their resonant wings like a violinist plays strings with bow.
Here in Gunpowder Wharf, the red of alder became the black of charcoal, was mixed with the yellow of sulphur and the white of saltpetre to make the grey of gunpowder. Now, the primary colours have seeped out, leaving the softness of the ruins and the many greens of the verdure that covers them. And green takes little account of the human. We humans are very many colours inside and out, but never really green, except unless it's around the gills on a particularly bad day. We're out on the marshes now, heading towards the estuary. The air is clear as glass, and a few pipistrelle and long-eared bats are hunting across the flat salt marsh grasses, flitting back and forth like silent scraps of the approaching night. Among the plants beside us is a pretty moth. She flutters half-heartedly around a cluster of golden samphire, before landing in a reed next to me. Her wings are a soft buff colour with cream diagonal stripes. Her shoulders are wrapped in dense fur, and we're incredibly lucky to see her because she is the rarest moth on the marshes, the ground lackey.
She looks rather slow and depleted.
She looks exhausted.
I am. Because let me tell you one thing for another. It's been a long, cold spring. Freezing my feet off, I was as a pup. So, I change up early, thinking at least then I'll have some fur, and maybe I can fly somewhere warmer. But to be honest, I shouldn't have tried. Oh, came out too soon. With the lack of forage, I was only ever a skinny pup. And also, plus anyway, how do I find my fellow? Daddy to my own pups, if I go off somewhere unknown. We ground lackeys used to be proud of being rare, you know. Living here in East Kent especially, it was like a prize or something. Like, how stupid, silly buggers is that? Did you know East Kent is home to the greatest concentration of rare and threatened moth species in the UK? Bet you didn't. Well, it might sound exciting, but it sure as bats is not if you're a moth. You have a look up of the rare moths in East Kent. You'll be astounded. There's the Bright Wave. Lovely name. They only live on one beach and three golf courses. Well, at least golf courses are good for someone. There's the Fiery Clearwing. Weird looking they are. A mixture of bee and moth, maybe. There's the White Spotted Sable. Everyone goes nuts for those because they look posh or so. But my favourite, and my mother met one, is the Sussex Emerald. Lovely soft green, she said, like you wouldn't believe in. Lives in Dungeness. Apparently, that's a desert. Might be it's warmer there. But no, I couldn't go all that way. I just got to work myself up to making the pheromones, and they got to be powerful, so that Mr. Ground Lackey Handsome can find me. It's worse for the poor fellows, really. They're out all hours, flying about, all night oftentimes. Out in the open is dangerous. Bats, cats, frost. That's on top of the trouble we all share. Development pressure, changing land management, limited resources, climate change, you name it. You don't just name it. You write reports on it. But what good is all that naming and writing if it just keeps on? It's a disaster, that's what, for us moths. A total disaster.
The ground lackey falls into silence and moves slowly away, low among the grasses. She's right. The situation is desperate for moths and for many others.
The statistics on insect loss are mind-boggling, and not in a good way.
Hard to conscience on a night like this, that seems so limpid and forgiving. The light is soft and rosy now, and the marsh is spread out before us like a laid table. A low sun in the west glitters on the creek and picks out every puddle and dip and channel of water. Everything is deep and soft and shining. A solitary human is lit up against the skyline, a flash of bright red in a world of soft greys, blues, ochres and greens. Below, the once impassably soggy marsh is channeled into hundreds of dikes and separated by a bank from the slick brown snake of Awl Creek.
The dikes nearest the sea are the most brackish, and they often have sea clubrush, which is slender with a fist of pointy fat fingers at the top. And common reed, that's the soft feathery one, whose seed heads are purplish when young. And fennel pondweed, which is really delicate and branching, and it actually floats on the surface of the water.
And that one? What's that? The one we're closest to with spiky seed balls that look like medieval instruments of war.
That's branched burreed. And then next to it is reed mace, which I grew up calling bulrushes, but that's actually formally incorrect.
But if everyone calls it a bulrush...
I think that's right. I mean, I looked it up and the internet agrees that this plant can now be called bulrush or reed mace, or dunhammer if you're Danish, or typha latifoli if you're scientific, or cattail, if you're North American.
Which reminds me of a joke. Why did the bull rush?
I don't know. Why did the bull rush?
Because it saw the cowslip. It looks like a huge brown sausage on a stick.
It does, if you see it at the beginning of the year, but like a pale, fluffy cat's tail if you see it at the end.
Okay, you get the picture. It's that one there, with the green and brown dragonfly perched on it. She's a beauty. Let's get a bit closer. Oh my word, her eyes are revolving.
Who does it think it's looking at?
As if I didn't know. Irresistible, aren't I, darling? Iridescent. A sparkling queen of the watery edges. I am so beautiful. Look at my wings. I still can't get over them. I think I really am at my best. Fresh as a daisy, but fully mature. Last week I still felt a bit sticky, and my colours weren't quite so bright. But some solid flying sessions have sorted me out. And the delicious airborne cuisine, especially those little shiny blue beetles. It's such fun to catch things on the wing. I can see what all the fuss is about. And fascinating to discover new tastes. Speaking of which... Ooh, now, that one's got a hint of citrus, I'd say, and a warm, oaky finish. Delish! I have always been known for my excellent palate, and my birth ditch food got a bit, well, samey after 3 years. You get this feeling, this itchy urge, you know? Not just in your shoulders, but in your head. Like a fizzing. For me, it came on after my 8th molt. That's actually quite precocious. I wanted to zip about and zigzag. I tried to teach myself how to swim backwards, straight up, down, and hover in the water. But it wasn't really happening. I kept getting water up my nose. But then one night, when a few of us got together for a natter, I mentioned it. And, well, I found out that it was a premonition of the magical process, the great transformative event. And they said, Persephone, you just need to be patient. Well, patient might be okay for them, but not for me. No. I decided I'm going to train. I'm going to practice. I'm going to skill up. I started a course of flying lotus meditation. I heard about it from a larva whose mother trained with a vagrant emperor who'd come here all the way from Africa on a warm southerly. Imagine! Anyway, he learnt it directly from a globe skimmer. Globe skimmers are famous. They fly across the oceans all the way from India to East Africa. Can you believe it? Marvellous. Monsoon chasing, they call it. It's a spiritual practice for them, as well as wonderful for the food. So, what you do every day is you visualise yourself flying further and further. Forwards, backwards, upside down, hovering, everything. And it worked. I climbed the reed before dawn, as we're all taught, and I went into deep meditation for the magical process. It only took me 2 hours to emerge, and then I stretched out in the sun and basked. As soon as I was dry, I could fly. I so want to travel. I know it's not traditional for us southern hawkers, but times are changing, aren't they? Especially for women. And it just sounds so thrilling. You could say I've got the bug. All those new sights. All those new flavours. Of course I need to mate and lay my eggs first. But then, watch me and weep. I'm off.
The dragonfly lifts off from her leaf vertically, like a helicopter. She performs a tight reverse swerve and swivels on her axis to offer us a last googling stare from those gold-green eyes.
All 30,000 facets.
Before zigzagging off down the dike. Below, in the rusty water, her younger siblings lurk.
Dragonflies spend most of their lives as wingless water larvae, crouching in the shadows and breathing through the gills in their anus.
Oh, no wonder she's thrilled to be airborne.
Our southern hawker's birth dike runs alongside and parallel to the raised path, which separates this still water from the fresh tidal waters of Ore Creek.
As the level rises and falls with each tide, acres of golden brown mud open and close. The mud looks perilous, unwholesomely shining and inviting, like a trap, like it might, as they said of the mud at the Somme, suck a person under into bottomless depths. But listen, the mud is crackling and popping. Hear that? It's like walking through a bowl of Rice Krispies.
It's home to over 350 species of invertebrate. Ragworms, lugworms, sandhoppers, cockles, snails, all breathing and growing and popping. Their bodies are food for a huge diversity and quantity of birds. So the mud is continually patrolled by waders. Many different species, some overwinter here, some visit as part of their migration north or south. Some are here for the breeding
Hello.
Season, and others make
Excuse
their lives
me.
Here all year round.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I do think you've skipped over the mud dwellers rather too briskly.
I'm sorry?
If I might be permitted to cut in, because we do get so overlooked. Even though we have the reputation among the mudders for being really the sexiest here. So, well, I think you should know more about us.
Well, that sounds fascinating. Please be my guest.
Thank you. Rigoletta here. My people come from Texas. But others here have folks all the way up Turtle Island. We've swum a long way to be here in North Kent. We're called bamboo worms because we're so slender and segmented. See here, y'all, down my creamy yellow and pale coral body, these beautiful red protruding segment rings, topped off by a pert little fantail. Friends say mine is particularly sweet. And we build us a real cute tube to live in, so that when we head down in the mud all day, we don't get picked off too easily by the gulls. So I guess you'd be forgiven for thinking us shy. But, well, let me tell you the story. All I can say is, if you don't want to get freaky or jealous, beware the spring tides of May. All the creatures get frisky in spring, I know it, but we bamboo worms take hot to a whole new spot. We're known for our orgies. Some of you science dudes call it swarm sex. Well, gotta say, we're not talking a few swingers behind the pampas on a Saturday night here. As the party approaches, we undertake some rather radical preparations. See here, I started to grow me the new segments. Mine are full of eggs. For the boys, it's sperm. And all of us, we make a single central eye spot. Then, in the last quarter of the moon in May, which is when the tides are at their most full, the most luscious, our erotic being ripens and releases to swim up into the shallows. We can tell by the light of the moon when we reach the surface. And once all of us, millions some years, are gathered together, we sway in the tide's arms and give thanks to the moon. And as the tide swells, we surge with her, ever hotter and happier, until, almost as one, we burst, sending our eggs and sperm to meld in a delicious crescendo of joy.
Indeed.
Yep. None of that hermaphrodite earthworm solo flying for us.
best not to judge, Rigoletta. I hear that earthworms are pretty good at self-pleasuring. But thank you. That was possibly the most romantic story I have ever heard from a worm.
Is it okay if we carry on now?
Yes, yes, waders. I know, waders. Nest sharp beaks on legs.
Now there's actually a pair of lapwings swirling through the sky ahead of us, great arms flapping as they whistle wit. The lapwing,
that's northern lapwing or green plover or peewit,
is a bird that looks like a shirt in a tumble dryer as it flies, all arms, and it has a really distinctive whistle. Do you hear? They're continually tumbling, wheeling through the sky, flashing white, then black, then white, then black, as you see first underside, then over, then under, then over.
Once you could see great flocks of them here in the winter, sometimes flying with other birds, like golden plover. When you get a closer look at a lapwing, you can see that actually they're not black on top at all, but a beautiful iridescent dark green and purple.
The whole time Rigoletta was talking, there's been another lapwing standing on the shore below us, down by the edge of the creek. And he's been there for ages, unusually motionless. One of the terns that's been screaming around has flown down and landed right next to him.
Why are you looking so down in the dumps, Mr. Peewit? Where's your girlfriend? She dumped you at last? You're not making the tappy tumbles no more? You're not falling through the sky for each other no more like the aerial dirty dancing Strictly Come Flying crew? Your wings finally got too big for your legs. What's up, Lappy? Lappy? You know I'm only teasing with you, Lappy. We're all friends. What's going on? What's wrong?
It has happened again.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes.
Oh, bird. I'm so sorry. I don't believe it. I should have thought. I should have known said nothing. Me and me big, big. I just cannot stop myself. I go in like a herring girl swoops for a chip, and then the chip is gone, and you see there wasn't a chip. It wasn't a chip. It was a chick. It was a baby. So tell me, Lappy, who did it? What happened? How did it happen? You tell me and I'll get them. I'll peg them.
I spent weeks practicing my performance this winter. Joyce said it was so moving. She said it was so convincing that even she kept thinking I was injured. I just don't understand. I must have got something wrong. Missed something out. Because it's not working. It's just not working. You know what us ground nesters are taught, Thomas. But however careful you are, however vigilant, however vocal, however brave, and for us plovers, however much visceral power you put into your acting, you will lose some eggs and you will lose some chicks. But you were taught there are always more chances, always another clutch. Like bird lore says, catch a lock and raise a clutch. Every bird learns that rhyme. That's how it's supposed to be. It's how it's always been. But look around you, Thomas. Look how few we are. How few. It's a lie.
I don't know what to say, Lappy. I remember my mother saying how things had got so bad for your people. Back way back before the one big one for you plovers. She said that you was almost gone from the marshes, all of you. We used to wonder why so. Cause you know, back then it was the humans what caught your eggs and they were no fooled by no acting, that's for sure. We just laugh at you as you run around with your broken wing, laughing with your big teeth. What's funny about killing chicks? That's what I wanna know, nothing, that's what. Then the big one came and made the birds deaf and the creepers fall down dead. You remembering? You got tall? Lots of humans, they die in that big bang. And then, after a bit, they no come no more to catch your eggs. Do you know if one led to other? Yes, probably. You know more?
It's all mixed up in my head, Thomas. My head is sore and old and full of the dark fog. I do remember being told as we was few before, like now, and that we came back more. Plover Law says that's why we must keep doing our best, that we must believe in ourselves. And if we do our very best, we can come back more again. But right now, that mooring back then, it seems like a blip on the line. Like the truth is, we're being called out of the world. We're being killed and lost out of the world, chip by chip. And any amount of tumbling and witting and loving and steadfast defending and the fineness of acting won't change that.
England banned the collecting of plovers' eggs in 1926, when their population was hanging by a thread. And the ban is Europe-wide now, although in Friesland, part of the Netherlands, they still have a cultural competition to find the first plover's egg each spring, but they don't get to eat it.
No. Now we just plough up their breeding grounds and use pesticide to kill their food.
Yeah, just as the ground lackey said, we write a report on a threatened species, have a summit on climate change, fund research into the sixth mass extinction event, and then build another airport. Are we addicted to progress? To the feeling of control it gives us? The UK government will spend £29 billion on updating Trident missiles, as if, amid all the other apocalyptic endgames, we still need the promise of nuclear war. When Ridley gets to the centre of devastation in Canterbury, he has a vision.
I could feel something growing in me. It were like a green sea surging in me. It was saying, lose it. Saying, let go. Saying, the onlyest power is no power.
To me, he's saying that real power comes when we step back from control and into belonging, appreciation. Not Lord of the Dance, just dancing.
Our pair of waders are still standing at the edge of the creek, where the indeterminate, continually shifting mud ripples and sucks at the point where the land oozes into the water, where one foot treads and the next swims. As they watch, both tide and day seep out. Finally, they rise up together to find their place for the night. The dusk chorus is mostly quiet now, and the marsh is left to the supersonic chirps and trills of the bats and crickets, and the pop and crackle of the mudders. The soft greens of the marsh and the primary colours of life and death are uniting now, softening and melding at the edge of black, becoming the all-encompassing night.